We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at will.illinois.edu. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. In a world whose peoples are more independent, interdependent than at the outset of the last century, we hear of climate change, peak oil, and economic and political disruption. And we think, what's coming? This afternoon, we'll get one person's take on the problems we face today and may face tomorrow. We'll also get her perspective on what we can do to address these challenges. Her concerns are the focus of a book that she's co-authored with Aaron Newton. The title, A Nation of Farmers, Defeating the Food Crisis on American Soil. Our guest this afternoon is Sharon Astick. She's a writer and a farmer. She farms with her family in New York State. She and her co-author are calling on more of us to farm and to think more critically about food. Let me share this with you from the book, A Nation of Farmers. What we eat and how we cook is at the root of everything, because before we can be a nation of farmers, we must be a nation of people who eat quite differently than we do. What shall we have for dinner is the question that is asked. In addition to A Nation of Farmers, Sharon Astick is the author of Depletion and Abundance and Independence Days. All three are published by New Society Publishers. You'll find our guest and her blog online at SharonAstick.com. And she spells her last name A-S-T-Y-K. Sharon Astick, welcome.
Thanks so much for having me.
Sure, my pleasure. Well, first of all, tell us about your farm. What's it like out there in New York?
Right at the moment, it's wet. It's been raining more or less nonstop for the month of June. You know, we get about 50 inches of rain a year, and I think we had half of it in the last month. But otherwise, it's pretty cool. We have 27 acres, which is a very, very small farm, certainly compared to anything where you are. It's a minuscule farm. But we raise pastured poultry and dairy goats and vegetables and wood for heating and a whole bunch of other odds and ends of things. And we used to run a CSA off of it, but then I started writing books and I decided I couldn't do both.
Yeah. Now, for those who don't know, what's a CSA?
A CSA is community supported agriculture. That means we delivered baskets that had fresh produce, eggs, and home baked bread and fresh flowers to our customers in the Albany Schenectady area for about 5 years.
Now, are you what's come to be called a locavore?
Well, I am. I'm not completely doctrinaire about it. We do eat some non-local food. We're not perfect. My kids like popsicles, and we eat the occasional avocado and things. But we do. We grow a lot of our food or buy it from local farmers, and we really have come to enjoy eating this way.
Yeah. I know that there's a recipe in the book that calls for pineapple that you provided, so... There are some things that you go to the store for.
Yeah, and actually, you know, my co-author actually lives somewhere where you couldn't almost grow pineapple, and if you give climate change another couple of years, he probably will be able to. But upstate New York is not a place where we're going to be seeing pineapple plantations anytime soon.
Well, how did you come to farming, and how long have you been on the farm?
We've been on our farm for about 8 years, and it was a completely insane thing. We actually had no preparation for this at all. I was a grad student in English literature. My husband is a professor of astronomy, and none of our training prepared us for this in any way, shape, or form. We didn't come from farm families. My husband grew up in an apartment in New Jersey, and I grew up in, you know, a small city north of Boston, and we all of a sudden took it into our head that, well, you know, if we were going to complain about industrial agriculture, we probably had to do something about it. We actually had to participate in producing food and eating better. And we decided all right, well, somebody is going to have to be the next generation of farmers because the average farmer is 58 years old, and their kids often don't want to farm or aren't prepared to farm because of the difficulty of farming in the United States. So somebody's going to have to do it. Why not us?
And how long have you been at it now?
8 years.
8 years, okay.
Yeah.
What was the learning curve for you two former urban dwellers?
It's been surprisingly easier than you'd think, although certainly with all sorts of entertaining drama. We've made every mistake you could possibly imagine, from planting a whole bunch of fruit trees in an area. We moved in during a drought year that we did not realize floods every spring, and that pretty much took care of that. Turns out that trees can't swim. Mm. We've made a whole bunch of mistakes, but we grew our first garden and all of a sudden grew more food than we could possibly eat. And we said, well, maybe we could share some of this, and started the CSA up the next year. So it was a tough learning curve, but a surprisingly successful one in some ways.
Mm.
You know, you'd think that you need to be better prepared than we were. And, they always say that God watches over children and fools. And we had fool going.
27 acres now. You know, I live in a part of the country. We live in a part of the country that the farms are really big, mm-hmm. most of them. But, gardening in my backyard is plenty enough challenge for me. I think 27 acres would be more than I could handle. How can you give us some sense of how it works and how you get stuff into the ground and how you get it out of the ground?
Well, I mean, we don't farm all 27 acres of it. A good portion of it is woodlot, and we manage that for some mushrooms and for firewood. We certainly don't. I mean, we farm mostly by hand. We don't have a tractor. We sometimes hire our neighbors to do stuff for us on our tractors. It's actually much cheaper on this scale for us to hire out than to own the tractor ourselves, since we're not super good at fixing things. And so what we do is our animals mostly do the harvesting themselves. We put up hay with a scythe, actually, very, very 19th century, but scything is actually really fun. I know that sounds a little insane if you've never done it, but it's actually not hard, and it's a surprisingly enjoyable thing. And then in terms of putting up the vegetables, at our peak, we were running an acre and a half of produce, which is really about as much as we could handle physically. Mm-hmm. And really, I mean, a lot of people run CSAs on much smaller gardens than that.
When and how did you begin thinking about your carbon footprint?
Well, we've thought about it for a long time. I don't know if I can answer when. Certainly since, the late 1990s. But it became a bigger issue for us, and I think for a lot of people, after 2006, when the IPCC report came out, latest IPCC report came out and said that climate change was happening, that we were facing this very serious thing. And then over the course of late 2006, early 2007, we saw that, in fact, the IPCC predictions for climate change were happening much, much faster than anybody ever thought. So the IPCC, for example, was saying that the Arctic might be ice-free by 2100, and then by the following summer, it became clear that the Arctic might be ice-free in 5 or 6 years.
Okay.
And so it became a much more acute issue as we realized that climate change is much further along than I think most people had realized.
Yeah. And the IPCC is?
Oh, sorry, the International Panel on Climate Change. They're the big international agency doing climate change research, and they've sponsored this sort of most definitive report on this subject. And so it's a little disturbing that the most definitive material we had at the time was 80 years off on, how fast, for example, the Arctic was warming, or on, they were vaguely worried that we might eventually, towards the end of the century, see methane starting to bubble up as the permafrost melted in the Arctic. Well, it turns out that's already started, and in 2007 we saw a jump in the amount of methane in the atmosphere because of that. And since there's an awful lot of methane, and methane is a very potent warming gas, that's a really serious issue because it could mean climate change runs away, goes past our ability to control it.
Mm. One of the things you mentioned in your discussion of our dependence on fossil fuels is that household energy uses household energy use amounts to 40% of total use. And large chunks of this come from, you know, the stuff we have in the house, ovens, refrigerators, freezers, and other food preparation and preservation appliances. How has your family worked to reduce household energy use?
Well, one of the things we've done is sort of get rid of a bunch of common appliances. We have a refrigerator, for example, but it's not plugged in. So because we have a freezer because we sell meat from our farm, pastured poultry and such, so we need to have a freezer. But it occurred to us, people used to keep food cold using ice boxes, and our freezer is a way to make ice. We could conceivably use our freezer, our fridge as an ice box, and we tried it. We started rotating ice packs around, and we found that, in fact, we were able to keep our food cool without running another appliance. So we were we've left our fridge off, and that saves about 150 kilowatt hours a month, which is a fair bit given that most of the United States electricity comes from coal. It's been a major thing for us to make an effort and say, okay, well, where can we cut down? Can we use a pressure cooker in order to cook those vegetables a little faster? Can we, use a hay box cooker or an insulated box to bring food to a boil and then put it in it and then let the food begin to cook? Because it really is one-third of the calories of energy we expend in our food comes from our household energy usage. Our fridges and stoves and things are big energy consumers.
Yeah, I've got a listener who wants to join our conversation this afternoon, so I'm going to go there next. Let me reintroduce you. Our guest this afternoon is Sharon Astick. She's a writer and a farmer. She farms with her family in New York State. She is the author, most recently, she's a co-author with Aaron Newton, of A Nation of Farmers, Defeating the Food Crisis on American Soil. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon with questions, comments. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number, that number, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Let's take a call now from a listener on line 4 in Pawpaw. Good afternoon.
Hey, good afternoon, Celeste and Sharon. I'm glad you're talking about this. I know I constantly call Celeste here and bug her every so often. But, this whole green energy thing has kind of gotten a little out of whack because for every good thing I can find, there's a negative thing. This is my wife saying I'm that glass half empty instead of half full or whatever. But I look at it practically, and I look at it, logically, and analyze everything. Okay, a good example of what I'm saying is everybody wants to go nuclear power. Well, the problem is, I know this for a fact, the places where we want to stick the used rods, people don't want it in their backyard. So where are you going to stick it if nobody wants nuclear waste? That's one thing. Okay, now I agree it burns cleaner, but you've got a problem with the waste. Secondly, all these light bulbs that you're getting rid of, and I've already been hearing problems with them as far as how to get rid of them. If thousands of people, hundreds of thousands of people put those in landfills, which they will, by the way, they won't recycle them because habits are hard to break, then you got that with that mercury. I know there's not much in them now, but if you combine them with hundreds of thousands of other light bulbs, then you got a problem. And then I start worrying about drinking water. The whole point is we're making houses that are inefficient. And I plan on building a house down south, down towards Champaign-Urbana, probably in another couple of years, where I'm going to try and use the latest, greatest gadgets that's more efficient, like high-efficiency furnaces. I'm going to try and get off of I'm going to start using for heating most of the time, if I can get away with it, is a potbelly stove or some kind of heating. If not that, I might go to the old water system like they used to have in the old 1800 buildings. We got to start looking at things differently. I hate to say it, when I was in college, the whole thing that I was taught was that, you know, the Earth goes in cycles. And I think we're in a cycle because we've gone through three ice ages. You know, things have changed dramatically. We've only been around long enough to study for, what, a couple hundred years. And unless you can study for another 100 years, I don't think you're going to come up with a definitive answer one way or the other, because every scientist out there can't make their mind up one way or the other.
And I'm going to interrupt here because we now have five topics on the table, thanks to our caller. So, listener, if you want to hang on, we'll try to attack these, and then we'll ask you for follow-ups. How about that? Okay, we've got nuclear power. We've got compact fluorescent bulbs, concerns about drinking water, energy-efficient homes, and weather cycles. Sharon, you got your work cut out there for you.
Well, that's a lot of material. They're all related to one another in some ways, or at least the first few are. I mean, I think that the caller really has the right idea that these sort of little partial fixes that we've sort of come up, well, let's increase efficiency a little bit here, let's use maybe something that looks a little better from one perspective here, are probably not sufficient solutions to the scope of our problems with energy and environmental issues. That is, we're facing, I think, a much deeper and more problematic situation than a lot of people realize. We've been told for a long time, all we have to do is make a shift to green energy. All we have to do is do this and this and this. Unfortunately, the reality is we don't have a lot of time. We are experiencing an acute shortage of capital to do those projects with. And we're experiencing a net energy decline worldwide. We're experiencing a period where it's harder and harder to get cheap fossil fuels. We don't have a lot of cheap energy to use on this massive build-out of green energy. So I think that the caller's really got it basically right, is that the compact fluorescence, and we will build some nuclear power plants, I suspect, and they do have real problematic issues. We do use compact fluorescence, but I don't think we're going to be able to fix our basic problems here with small refinements. We really need something much bigger, and that's one of the issues we try to take up in the book, is this question that the food system, just like our energy system, just like our ecological systems, can't be handled by small refinements. Well, we'll just have sort of industrial organic agriculture, or we'll just do things a little bit differently. We really are facing a situation where we have to do a lot of things really very, very differently.
Okay. The listener want to come back?
Yeah, I agree with you. I mean, our living habits have to go 180 from what we've been. We're I don't want to say we're greedy, but we live well beyond our means. And, I mean, the only thing, you know, it really gets my gourd when I hear people out there saying, let's go green, buy this, buy that. You know, cars are a good example. I mean, we don't have the infrastructure laid out for electric cars. We don't have the infrastructure built out for a lot of these things that everybody wants to build now. It's going to take years. It's like the computer. I mean, and people are so impatient nowadays, they can't wait. You know, my point being, in the whole scenario of things, analyze things. You know, I like to go from backwards, and you've already probably figured this out. I like to figure out what the problems might be, you know, X amount of years down. I'm a contractor, and I could tell you what, we don't make things to last. You know, water heat doesn't last, you know, windows don't last. All these things that we make nowadays, none of them last, and it comes down to the bottom line. Can we do it better? Can we make them last longer? Sure. But I firmly believe it's the money factor. I'll get off and listen. You guys have a great show. Thanks, Celeste.
Okay, thanks for the call this afternoon. Sharon, you want to follow up on his comment?
Well, I mean, I think that making things to last is going to be one of our central projects, and rescaling our loss is going to be one of our central projects. I don't think I agree with the caller. I don't think we're greedy for the most part in the sense that sometimes people talk about greed. I mean, I think that most Americans have the right basic values. That is, they have the desire to do the right thing and be good people. But I do think that our sense of how to live our lives, what are the most important of our values, have shifted over the last 50 or 75 years in ways that are really problematic given the sort of crisis we're facing in food, in energy, this sort of ecological depletion that we're facing. I think, quite honestly, we really have to start thinking about ourselves as some we need to go back to maybe an older vision of what it means to be American. For example, I mean, we took the title of our book, A Nation of Farmers, from Thomas Jefferson's letters to John Jay, where he argued that a nation of independent farmers beholden to no one, who provided for most of their needs, who had a measure of self-sufficiency, were the best possible citizens, that they weren't obligated to any special interest. They could vote honestly and look at the world honestly. And we chose that in part because, you know, we look at politicians and we say, okay, a politician who takes a lot of money or depends on resources from a corporation, we would suggest that there's probably something wrong with their judgment, that we shouldn't trust them on subjects involving that corporation. But is it good for us to depend on corporations for our very food and clothing and shelter? And we need to start thinking about maybe how can we provide some of those needs ourselves.
So essentially becoming more self-reliant.
More self-reliant, but also more interdependent. That is, that not everybody has to do everything for themselves. We're going to need communities, and we're going to need strong networks of people connecting resources. For example, both a lot of rural areas in the United States and a lot of urban areas have some of the same problems. It's very hard to get good food in both of them. The rural areas may grow acres and acres of corn and soybeans, but they often don't have that many vegetable gardens anymore, and they don't have supermarkets, so people have to drive a long way. The urban areas often have bodegas and convenience stores, but not places where you can buy a lot of produce. And both areas are often impoverished. They're often struggling to get by. Well, that need for food and the land that rural areas have on the one hand and the sort of dense populations whose money adds up. The poorest neighborhood in Washington, D.C., for example, spends $366 million a year on food. That's a lot of money. Making connections between these interdependent areas that can both help each other is going to be really important.
Yeah. We have seen, it seems to me, in recent years, and this continues, a number of quite serious books about food, agriculture, and sustainability. The Omnivore's Dilemma comes to mind. Recently, I spoke with a woman who has written a book about cooking green, reducing your carbon footprint in the kitchen. We have your book, A Nation of Farmers. It seems to me that we're in a period where we're looking at this. What do you make? How significant is this? What do you make of it?
I think it's enormously significant. I think the fact that the Omnivore's Dilemma made the New York Times bestseller list for a very extended time, that Barbara Kingsolver's Animal Vegetable Miracle made the New York Times bestseller list, is really radical. I mean, the fact that we're thinking about food not as, you know, not just through cookbooks or HDTV, but we're thinking about where our food comes from, about agriculture, and about sort of our relationship to our food, really is a radical change. Wendell Berry has said that the American people in modern times have become the most thoughtless eaters in history. And it hasn't been possible for most people historically to be thoughtless eaters. It was necessary for them to know something about their food because, after all, if they didn't, then they might not have enough. I think our disconnection from our food system, the fact that a lot of children don't even know whether a carrot grows under the ground or on a tree, is a really serious problem, and I'm delighted to see a shift away from that and a real shift to the awareness that these ordinary, everyday things like food and water and shelter, that to some degree we sort of said weren't probably as important as foreign policy and political issues, are getting the attention they deserve.
Mm. Food is a very political issue. In the last couple of decades, we've seen a boom also in farmers' markets. Champaign-Urbana now has three, and one of the newest is on the eastern edge of downtown Champaign. And one goal of the new market is to be close to people who may find transportation to the Urbana market a problem. Another goal, the market is open on Wednesdays, and that is in the middle of the week, whereas the Urbana market is open on Saturday morning, and there is a market in southwestern Champaign on Thursday now. Have you seen a growing interest in these markets serving those who previously might not have had access? And question number two, why do you think these markets have grown so much in popularity?
Well, I think some of it is the publicity that good food has gotten. I mean, I think it's really important that more and more people are really concerned about safe food. I mean, quite honestly, I'm not convinced that the sustainable food movement has done as much in its own service as the industrial food movement has done for us. I mean, you know, melamine, E. coli, you know, botulism, you name it. Every time that happens, more people show up at the farmer's market. So to some degree, I think this is a response to this perception, which I think to a degree is truly accurate, that our food supply isn't safe, that we are operating now on a scale where people can't provide the supervision that's really needed. And in fact, I think that's self-evident. This year, Kraft Foods gave testimony before Congress, basically begging Congress to regulate food suppliers because they can't even keep track of where the food is coming from anymore, even within Kraft's own, you know, production level. So I think really that we are sort of, there is this widespread perception that we're looking for food that's going to be nourishing, it's going to be safe, it's going to maybe support the kind of culture and community that we want. And that's really helped farmers markets out. The other one has been this awareness that, you know, farmers, that there's a desire for good food, for clean food, for healthy food, for safe food, not just among affluent consumers, but all across the board. Today on CNN, there was an article about the rise of community gardens in poor African-American neighborhoods in mm-hmm. Atlanta. And there's this, the reality is that this is not an elitist movement. The idea that organic and sustainable food is an issue only for rich white leftist consumers is, I think, wrong. Everybody is worried about their food, and it's wonderful to see these farmers markets springing up and inspiring both more farmers who realize that they can make a living this way and more eaters who are getting access to better, safer, and healthier food.
Yeah. A book just came across our desks here at the station yesterday or the day before, and it's about a woman who's created a farm in downtown Oakland. Interesting things afoot. Well, let's get to the heart of the matter here, a nation of farmers. One of the things you would like to do or like to see happen is to have more of us farm. How many and what constitutes a farm, and when does one go from gardener to farmer?
Well, I would actually like to suggest that the line between gardener and farmer is not a very hard one. And that's maybe a tough thing to sell in rural Illinois, you know, where the farms are, you know, 5,000 acres, can be 5,000, 10,000 acres of land, you know. So, and it's probably easier to sell out here where the farms, because our land is steep and it's hilly and rocky, never got that big to begin with. But if you look all over the world, in most of the world where there aren't a lot of fossil fuels involved in agriculture, somewhere between 25 and 35% of the population is involved in agriculture in some way. Now, that doesn't mean that everybody is a full-time farmer. A lot of agriculture, for example, happens in cities. A surprisingly large percentage of food is grown in cities. For example, Hong Kong grows about 20% of its meat and 20% of its produce inside the city limits, and Hong Kong is one of the densest cities in the world. So a lot of this takes place in urban places on tiny, tiny lots that we would never call farms. But what you see when you look at farms from a world perspective is that 85% of the farms in the world are under 5 acres. That's the vast majority of all farms. The vast majority of all farmers are not, you know, they're not a big guy with a tractor and a hat, you know, farming 1,000 acres. They're a woman, usually a non-white woman, in a household where at least one person in the household does some kind of off-farm work. And that's actually the only thing that's in common with American farmers is no matter how large they are, most American farmers have to have one partner in the family work off the farm now to get health insurance or to make ends meet. And many of those farms are much, much smaller than 5 acres. They're things that we would call gardens. And I think one of the reasons we call for a nation of farmers is we know that most people aren't going to have large acreage farms. But it's so important that we start growing food where people really live, that we start growing it in cities and suburbs, on lawns, where, you know, where we've been, you know, wasting water and chemicals growing lawns. It's so important that we engage people who we would normally call gardeners and who, when they think of them as gardens, they often think of their contribution as a very, very small one. But in 1944, all of the Victory Gardens combined in the United States grew as much produce as all of the produce farms in the United States combined. That is, the Victory Gardens matched the produce farms in total vegetable production. So one of the things we want to say is it's not really about how big your plot of land is. It's about getting the most and the best out of it, about using the right sort of techniques of husbandry to sort of minimize climate change by enriching the soil with organic matter and keeping topsoil in place. And it's about getting food where we need it. And some of those farms are going to be really huge and some of them are going to be tiny. But we called for 100 million farmers, which is crazy. we know that. I mean, it's a nice round number, and it's easily memorable. But we called for that number without distinguishing between farmers and gardeners, because we really do need a large percentage of the population involved in their food system, whether it's in backyard gardens or whether it's with large acreage. We're facing a major demographic crisis in agriculture in the United States. The average farmer in the United States is 59 years old. They are going to retire probably in the next 10 to 15 years. And there aren't enough young farmers coming up behind them to replace that. So even if we didn't have any of these other concerns, even if we didn't have to worry about energy and climate change, we'd have to ask ourselves, where are the next direct generation of people who are going to feed us come from? And because they're not going to come out of the farms, because we have less than 2% of the United States population farming anymore, because so many farmers don't even want their children to go into farming because it's been such a difficult, volatile job where people lose their livelihoods in bad years, we're going to have to get the next generation of farmers out of the gardens and out of the cities and out of the edible schoolyards and the small agricultural colleges and things. So we're going to, it's not going to matter so much how much acreage there is as much as this sense that we're engaged in some kind of collective project. Mm-hmm.
Our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine is writer and farmer Sharon Astick. She and Aaron Newton are the co-authors of A Nation of Farmers. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon with questions, comments. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Toll-free 800-222-9455. Let's take some more calls. Next, we go to a listener in Champaign on line 2. Hi.
Hello. Hi. Hello, Ms. Astick. I am so glad that I flipped the radio on when I walked in from work today, because I am a regular reader of your blog and very deeply appreciate your insights into this very complex problem that we face as a nation, and I found it quite inspiring and heartening. So thank you for coming on. It's wonderful to actually know what you sound like as opposed to just seeing your words on a computer screen.
Thank you.
I guess I could go a million directions with this. Opportunity to ask you one question. I suppose part of what I'm interested in mainly is in my own personal life, I have met a woman who seems to be interested in being a farmer, amazingly enough. Neither of us grew up in that life, although we did. I grew up here in central Illinois, so I'm sort of have passing familiarity with at least the large-scale industrial farming. And I guess one of the things that we're starting to run into as we move deeper into our relationship is the idea that, well, what about the cultural connotations? What about the cultural baggage associated with being a homemaker or someone who stays at home? Because our own personalities seem most inclined, as I think, if I remember rightly, your husband's and yours division of responsibilities is that my skill set enables me to go out into the world to pursue a career, to bring in the cash, while my girlfriend's skill set seems more well-suited to staying at home and taking care of the family and raising children while they're young, and then later, once the children are able to be supported, moving on into a second career. And then I would come home after work and do what she tells me to take care of the chores. And it's a wonderful vision for the future, and it's something I very much want to do if we could possibly do it. But I'm worried that we're invoking all of these terrible cultural connotations about men being breadwinners and women being homemakers. And, you know, and for the two of us, I mean, her vision is to be that very competent 30s kind of era housewife who was just knew how to do everything and was always on top of things and was active in the community. And, you know, that, and then the fact that she wasn't bringing in money every week was not demeaning because she was competent and she brought in economic value into the household. This whole ties into Wendell Berry's notions about revitalizing the home economy, making that a meaningful phrase again, as opposed to just talking about the way you happen to organize your specific house, making it a center, a locus of economic activity so that you have diversity in your income streams and you can support yourself, not if you lose your job. You're not completely up the river without a paddle.
Okay.
So, I mean, yeah, I'm sorry, I'm just pouring information out at you because it was a wonderful burst of opportunity for words I don't often get to say to people, but I'm just curious to know, like, in terms of those cultural connotations of couples as they consider a homesteading or a farming kind of lifestyle, how they can think about that in a meaningful and useful way.
Okay.
Well, congratulations, first of all, on finding love. That's a big thing. the second thing I'd say is that I'm all for, as much as possible, ignoring the cultural presumptions. We have a real tendency in our society to demean domestic work, to say that sort of the things we do for our subsistence, you know, the things we do to make sure we're fed and clean and we save money as opposed to making it, don't count as much as actually earning money. So I actually think that that's a mistake. And one of the things that has led us to be so profligate with energy and with resources is when we started moving everybody out into the public workforce, that takes a lot of energy and it takes a lot of resources. You know, that's when you start needing that second car. That's when you start needing, when you start needing to drive to drop people off at daycare and then to make, you know, and you're too tired to do the cooking. So that's when we start eating fast food on the way home. And now this sounds like I'm blaming women for our energy usage, and I don't want it to sound that way. In fact, I think a lot of feminists worked really hard to say that what should have happened is instead of us all buying fast food is that men should have been doing their share of the cooking if women were going out to work. But it didn't quite work out that way. And I think it's really important that we reengage in subsistence labor, and I don't have a problem with that working along gender roles or not, as people prefer. The one thing that I would say is I think it's worth noting that in the current recession, 80% of the people who have lost their jobs have been men. There are two reasons for that. One is that we've disproportionately hit the construction industry, Wall Street, other heavily male industries, whereas less so among, you know, sort of traditionally female professions. The other reason has been women get paid less than men, and so it's cheaper to keep them than it is to keep the men. So what we have, I think, is a really interesting situation where you have an awful lot of families where the traditional breadwinner is now out of work, and that's a really serious situation. So one thing that I would say is that I think it's really important that as much as possible people try to maintain skills so that if they have to, both parties can go out into the public workforce to keep the wolf from the door. And also that even if you're less skilled at household management, do a lot of watching what your girlfriend does because you never know when it may be you out there cooking dinner and it might be you out there in the garden, even if you didn't plan it that way. I mean, sometimes that's how things work.
I want to thank the listener for his call. We're running down on time. I've got two other people who I'd like to get into the discussion this afternoon. Next, we go to a listener on a cell phone, line 4. Hello. Line 4?
Is that me?
That's you.
Okay, good deal. I find this this topic very interesting, and I don't know a whole lot about it. So, but I was wondering what you do for fresh produce in the winter, when obviously you can't be growing that because it's so cold.
We do a number of things. I preserve a lot of food. My forthcoming book, the one that's coming out this fall, is called Independence Days, and it's about food preservation because I think that's such an important project in, if you're going to eat locally, those of us who live up here in the north have this issue that, you know, there's really not a lot of strawberries available in January if you're eating locally. So one thing is learning how to preserve, and sometimes that means canning and freezing, and sometimes that means extending your garden season so that you have more fresh produce for longer, or putting things in cold storage. Sometimes it's root cellaring, but I do it on my on a porch that's enclosed on my house. And so we preserve a lot of things. We have squash and roots and potatoes and greens and cabbage and things that are kept cold. And we eat a lot of stuff that we dry and pickle and can. And then we do buy some stuff that's out of season to keep going. I mean, we'd like a little broccoli in February just like everybody else. But it's one of those things where along with this sort of local eating project goes this question, again, of how are we going to cook the food and how are we going to preserve it?
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
You're welcome. Next we go to a listener in Indiana on line one. Hi.
Hello.
Hi.
Yeah, I'm so glad for the topic today. We've been participating in a farmer's market locally here for about 5 years. It takes about that long to get one going. I would encourage anybody that's a part-time gardener like I am to participate and start a very local farmer's market. And I don't make that much money on it, but I make a few thousand bucks. But my gardening gives me a lot of the things I like dried tomatoes and fire-roasted peppers and that sort of thing. I just think that on a large scale, it's just exactly what we need to kind of recession-proof our local economies and have a higher quality of food. And I thank you for the topic.
Okay. Sharon, you want to follow up?
I'm just delighted. I'm always pleased to see people farming part-time because it's not an all-or-nothing thing. That is, anybody who's gardened knows that, you know, on a good year you get a little extra and you can pass it on to the food pantry, you can pass it on to your neighbors, you can take it out and sell it. There's a lot of potential for small supplemental incomes for retirees or for homemakers or for other people to really help them get along in these really tough times.
Yeah, I want to thank the listener for his call this afternoon. We had a guest on the program recently, and someone who called in earlier, I think it was the listener in Champaign, called in and said that he'd found love and they're thinking about farming. I talked with a woman who was very interesting. She was a guest here on the program, sometime in this month anyway. She is a former journalist, now a historian in rural Minnesota, and she wrote this book, More Than a Farmer's Wife. These are voices of American farm women in the first half of the 20th century. Very interesting material. Anyway, one of the things that she mentioned, Amy Mattson-Lauders, when she was on the program, was that she in rural Minnesota is seeing people move back to the country to farm on a small scale, to have a place. Are you seeing anything like this in the East? And do we have any numbers on this? Is this a trend? What's going on?
Well, that's a really good question. I think that we are seeing this. I think there's a sense that people are starting to look to small-scale farming. I know that very small organic farms are starting to grow. The other thing, the only fast-growing segment of American agriculture at this point is actually independent women farmers. So we suffer a little bit, I think, in the United States from what I like to call farmer's wife syndrome, where we sort of have this idea that we have the farmer and we have the farmer's wife, and that inevitably if there's a man and a woman, the woman is not a real farmer. And I think it's really neat to see the stories of American farm wives and American women farmers being told. There definitely is a movement back to the land. I don't know that we really have a lot of good numbers on how many people are doing this at this point, particularly since so many of them are just getting started. They're just coming out to their first farmers markets. They're just getting going. But I think there definitely is this transition, and I think it's a really good thing. We're also seeing in cities like Detroit, where we're seeing so much foreclosure and we're seeing poverty, we're starting to see bringing the farm back to the city. That is, as houses are knocked down or they can't be sold, that land is starting to get turned into productive garden land, which is really quite astonishing and the one good thing may be in an ocean of bad stuff.
Yeah, well, there we have to leave it. We're out of time. Sharon Astick, thanks for being with us this afternoon.
Thanks so much for having me.
Sharon Astick and Aaron Newton are together the authors of A Nation of Farmers. In addition to that book, she is the author of Depletion and Abundance, and coming this fall, Independence Day. All these books are or will be published by New Society Publishers. Independence Day will be published by New Society Publishers. Out now, A Nation of Farmers. You'll find our guest, Sharon Astick, and her blog online at www.sharonastick.com. She spells her last name A-S-T-Y-K.